City FM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, it's the NATO summit this weekend. The Russians say they'll attack Eastern Europe if NATO install the missile defence shield. Plus, the far right beat up, hospitalise and disable a Palestine supporter in Bristol city centre in broad daylight. Avon and Somerset police say they know who it is, so why is the attacker apparently still walking the streets? A fighter war without hurting anyone. We're joined by Tim Pope from Bristol's Lincoln Barn War Game Society, who had their annual tabletop sale this weekend. But first, Martin Summers is here for our weekly reconnaissance across world political topics. Now, Martin, first of all, we've got all the world's royalty, pretty much, apart from Queen Sophia of Spain in London at the moment, for a lunch. What's been called the Liar's Lunch at Windsor at lunchtime, and then there's a dinner, which is the Despot's Dinner at Buckingham Palace, beginning very soon today. The big protests have been mainly about the Bahraini royal family. To what extent do you think that it's right to have protests and controversy on occasions like this? Because, I mean, isn't there an argument that maybe the Queen might use, saying, well, look, I've invited these people to dinner to try and persuade them to be good chaps?
Well, I don't suppose they're going to be discussing political matters at all. It'll be small talk. I think if they want to invite the Bahraini royal family, that's up to them. But they understand that the Bahraini royal family's evil reputation will rub off on everybody else at the gathering. And the Bahraini royal family are no better and no worse than Colonel Gaddafi. And maybe they should go the same way as Colonel Gaddafi.
Peter Tatchell, the human rights campaigner, decried any invitation for the Bahraini royals as outrageous, telling the UK Huffington Post that he expected 8 dictators to be on the guest list. It's funny, isn't it, because we hear about dictators like Gaddafi, but actually the kings and queens, to a certain extent, are just dictators as well.
Well, the Saudi royal family certainly are dictators, and they invaded Bahrain as well. I mean, they crossed an international boundary, as Saddam Hussein crossed an international boundary into Kuwait, but we don't hear anything about that because they're our allies. But of course, as our allies, we are responsible. They're the biggest buyers of British military equipment, much of it produced in Bristol. And if we want to be allied with the Saudi royal family, which we apparently do, or our government does, then you'll have to take the licks when the people kick back. We're allied with Saudi Arabia. Maybe the Saudis might decide it's time for British people to start paying the price for being allied with their dictators.
Now, heads of state, these kings and queens, are really supposed to be figureheads. Do they have any real political power?
Some are figureheads and some aren't. The Bahraini royal family aren't figureheads, are they? The Saudi royal family aren't figureheads. They run those countries.
And what about links to the military? Because obviously the military all here in Britain, the armed forces, all swear allegiance not to David Cameron, but to the Queen.
Well, yes, and of course in the 1970s there was the famous potential coup cooked up inside the British military against the then Labour government. And of course, you know, what should have happened with those military officers that were involved in that? They should have lost their jobs and they should have been sent to prison. But of course they weren't. The whole thing was hushed up.
Now,
break the law, you should be sent to prison.
Is there really any real evidence that there was a possible coup attempt in Britain in the 70s?
There was. There's very definite evidence. If people should watch The Plot Against Harold Wilson, the BBC Two film, which was shown a few years ago with James Boland playing Harold Wilson, it was quite clear that there was an attempted coup. It was stymied, but there was definitely people serving military officers who were involved, for example, in a takeover of Heathrow Airport, where they claimed that it was a terrorist threat when there wasn't. It was an attempt to intimidate the Labour government of the day. So millions of pounds of taxpayers' money was spent on the say-so of military officers in order to intimidate the elected government of the day. Those officers should have been sent to prison. They weren't. Now, ultimately, in every society, the military is a potential threat to democracy.
Okay.
This one.
What about, getting back to my main point, how much political power do these kings and queens, maybe the European ones that have a democratic things going on in parallel with them, how much power do they really have?
Well, it depends which country we're talking about, doesn't it? I mean, you know, the monarchy in Denmark is a fairly sort of, you know, kitchen sink sort of affair. And they wouldn't have any real power. They would, the government of the day will decide. In Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, you're talking a different kind of ball game, aren't you?
Now, this big get together ostensibly is for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, but if you look at the names that are sitting around the table tonight at Buckingham Palace, having their supping away, at least half of them are members of this thing called the Spanish Order of the Golden Fleece, which is actually a club for kings and queens in Europe, which was started in medieval times and has been going ever since. The Golden Fleece itself is based on, you know, in a way, of course, it links back to the Olympics, because it's all to do with Greek myths and legend and the old Greeks, the ancient Greeks. But the Golden Fleece apparently was owned, and this is in Homer's legends, was actually the fleece of the ram god of Colchis, which was a small island, now part of modern-day Georgia, on the easternmost shore of the Black Sea. And if you've ever seen any of the films of Jason and the Argonauts, this features in there. So, in a way, the idea of having a sort of Order of the Golden Fleece is almost like sticking two fingers up at the public, because the whole thing of the Golden Fleece is it was a charm for wealth. It was almost like saying, well, you know, this, if so long as we keep the Golden Fleece, we are going to be rich, powerful and wealthy. So in a way, they're kind of sticking two fingers up, aren't they, at the public with these gatherings like this, with orders that go back literally hundreds of years.
Well, I mean, as we know, the case for royal families and kings and queens is somewhat disputed. I mean, the Americans went to war over it in the 1770s.
Well, we did, didn't we? We had an English Civil War, apparently.
Indeed, we went to war over it in the 1640s.
So what happened after the English Civil War then? Because it looks like the whole everything that people were fighting for, Cromwell won, was sort of given up, wasn't it, when Charles II was brought back in?
What you'll find is there's a spectrum, isn't there? You've got constitutional monarchies, absolutist monarchies, and you've got republics, and you know, there's a variety of different political systems around the world. I'm far more worried by the scamsters on Wall Street and the military industrial complex than I am by the royal families, although the royal families are linked into the military industrial complex and the money people, and the Bilderberg group, which we'll be meeting sometime soon, your pet bete noire. I mean, they have royalty, money people and military industrial complex people and media people all in the same room at the same time.
For me, the thing that makes me laugh about the Order of the Golden Fleece is that it's not just the kings and queens of Europe and the princes and any heirs to the throne. It's also a couple of interesting extra characters. One is Nicolas Sarkozy, who was appointed to the order just after he joined.
But it says here because he's co-prince of Andorra.
Is that why?
Yes. That's why. But Andorra is a medieval anomaly between France and Spain. Yeah.
But you would have thought, wouldn't you, as the French Republic, that that they would be the last people to be joining the Order of the Golden Fleece.
But it's because he is co-prince of Andorra.
The other person who's on that list, which you may not have noticed, Martin, is Rasmussen, their Secretary General of NATO. For some reason, he's also part of this little club.
Well, I don't know how they managed to get him in there.
And we've got quite a lot going on this weekend, haven't we? We've got not only the G8 summit in the United States, that's today and tomorrow, but Sunday and Monday is the big get-together of NATO, the annual get-together.
Yes, in Chicago.
And they will obviously, one of the things they'll be discussing there is the missile shield. So can you just explain this business of what's going on in Romania? Because
it's Romania and Poland, but what you said earlier, that the Russians have said they will attack these missile batteries if they're put in place, that's not quite right. What the Russians have said and what Putin has said is we reserve the right to attack these missile batteries if you put them in place. We're not necessarily going to attack them, but we're not ruling it out. It's a bit like the West says to Iran. We're not necessarily going to attack you, but we're not attacking you off the table.
Well, the Americans...
And the Russians are saying exactly the same about these missile batteries.
Well, the Americans
are... necessarily going to attack you, but we reserve the right to attack you if we feel like
it. The Pentagon this week has rolled out... what it says is we now have the plan to attack. Iran is now ready to go.
Well, maybe so. And Putin is giving them back the paying them back in their own coin by saying, if you put these missile batteries in, we reserve the right to knock them out preemptively, just as you do. So, you know, you go in for preemptive strikes without rules. Well, that, okay, well, we might go in for preemptive strikes without rules. The Russians are pretty fed up about these missile batteries. They don't see the West has said, well, they're directed at the North Koreans. They're directed at the Iranians. They said, well, why are they in our backyard? I mean, Putin at a previous summit said, well, listen, if you want to have missile batteries to threaten the Iranians, why don't you put them in Azerbaijan? I've actually spoke to the people in Azerbaijan, which is right next to Iran, and you can put them there. And they went, no, we want to put them in Poland.
But we've got a situation here, haven't we, which in some ways is a sort of mirror of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, yeah, where new weapons were put right next to the United States by the Russians.
Indeed, and both the Russians and the Chinese have concluded that the West is basically spoiling for a fight. And both the Russians and the Chinese have decided, well, if you're going to spoil for a fight, we're going to make that bit difficult for you. You're not just going to put these weapons in and expect to get away with it. There will be consequences.
So is it possible that as those weapons start to be installed, the concrete is poured in, etc., and the military hardware is installed in Poland and Romania, that one morning that everyone comes back to find the whole place has been blown to pieces by Russian missiles?
Well, the Russians are saying that you've got to take that into account as you proceed, because we're very, very unhappy about you putting these missiles in here. And, you know, before you actually put the missiles in, we might knock out the stuff you're building to put them in.
Also, tension in the South China Sea, isn't there? I mean, you were mentioning the Chinese. We just talked about the Russians, yeah, and confrontation with NATO countries. Also, the Chinese are too.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Philippines and the Chinese are disputing aspects of the South China Sea where there's oil. And There was a joint US-Philippines military exercise in the South China Sea, which the Chinese denounced, and then the Chinese had their own military exercise. People in the West are not really being told how unhappy and upset the Chinese and the Russians are with us. They are very unhappy and upset, but we're just being told, oh, they're just griping, don't worry about it.
But to what extent is this the Chinese up in the ante, and to what extent is it NATO and the West?
Well, listen, both of these confrontation points in Poland and Romania and the South China Sea are right next to Russia and China. Can you imagine if the Russians and the Chinese were carrying out exercises in the Channel and saying, hey, don't worry about it, it's not directed at you, we're just having an exercise in the Channel in international waters? We would go bonkers. So this is actually the West is on the march. The West is the one making threats. The West is threatening Iran. The West is threatening Russia. The West is threatening the Chinese. We are the warmongers. That's how we're seen in the rest of the world. We are the warmongers, and millions have died through Western warmongering in the last decade. People are fed up with it, and World War III could easily kick off, and the West won't be guaranteed to win, because you know what? We're not prepared for it in any way, shape or form psychologically.
But surely nobody...
And most of the West is full of cowards
and bullies.
But Martin,
surely nobody wants that.
Nobody in Russia and China wants it, but they've been bending over backwards to try and come to some agreement about nobody seems to be interested.
But what about even in this part of the world? Surely there's nobody that actually wants to kick off a third world war.
Not from amongst the ordinary people, but the ordinary people are being basically kept in ignorance of what's going on.
Who stands to gain, and what would they stand to gain?
The military-industrial complex always stands to gain from militarism. That you know, it keeps in the most basic thing in the world, it keeps people in overtime in Filton. That's what and pays for their holidays.
Yes, but they're not running the country.
No,
they're
not. But they've got to understand that if you're producing weaponry and making money out of it and getting holidays out of it, one day you might come to work to find a car bomb in your face from the other side, who get the weapons thrown in their faces all the time. If we want to specialise in Britain in producing weapons, which we supply to the Saudis, if I was a Saudi patriot, I might decide, hang on a minute, the head of BAE Systems, the one that's supplying the weaponry that's repressing us in Saudi Arabia, my brother's been tortured to death. Maybe I should go around and put a bullet through his head, because we've got no other form of redress in Saudi Arabia. I'm not encouraging people to do this, but British people who have their fingers in pies all over the world, we send our armies to the other side of the globe, and we think that we're invulnerable here. The obvious answer for people who are fighting against the British elsewhere is to take the war to us right here.
So what would you suggest then?
I suggest that we all take a step back and start acting sensibly and negotiating with everybody else. The Russians are totally unhappy about these missiles being put in Romania and Poland. The West would be wise to drop it. They don't work anyway. there's no evidence that they're going to work. They're supposed to knock down missiles as they come in towards the west. There's no evidence that these systems work. So in a way, the Russians are pretty calm about it because they know that these things don't work. But why needlessly provoke them? What's that about? Why are we doing it? Well, we're doing it because some factions within the West are determined to provoke a third world war. We're not kidding. The Russian General Staff, General Ivashov, who was in command of Russian armed forces on 9/11, says, as far as I'm concerned, that was an inside job. Now, so most people have not been told in this country the position of the Russians is, or of General Ivashov is, that 9/11 was an inside job. So the West is killing thousands of its own people in order to provoke a war hysteria so that they can invade Iraq, invade Iran, invade Afghanistan, and everybody else in the world is getting fed up with it.
Well, before we get off the subject of Ministry of Defence procurement and the arms trade, it's pretty obvious now that Philip Hammond, the new Defence Secretary, after the removal of, or the resignation of, the North Somerset MP Liam Fox, the previous Defence Secretary, is now in negotiations with BAE Systems, one of the biggest arms manufacturers in the world, obviously with offices themselves up at Filton and owners of Filton Airfield, to privatise Abbey Wood, which is the Ministry of Defence procurement.
Well, again, this is more money for the boys, isn't it? Or the girls.
I mean, surely that's just not feasible, to have arms companies overseeing Ministry of Defence contracts.
It is. Well, don't forget that this whole thing is a way of diverting public resources into private pockets, and then BAE Systems and others will then be funding politicians in the Conservative Party who will do more of the same, and the same happens with Wall Street, and so it goes and so it goes. So in other words, the British taxpayer is being milked by these private military companies.
But that's not democracy, is it? Where is it going wrong?
Well, because we haven't got a proper democracy. We've got, what we've got is a very, very weak control by civil society over the state, over these private centres of power. And it's always been that way. I mean, Britain basically has always been run by a ruling class. It still is.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it's Olympic year, as everybody knows. In a few weeks' time, it'll all be kicking off. But we've seen the lighting of the Olympic torch and the sort of trail going around Britain. The Guardian have come up with a fascinating article today about the history of this whole idea of having a torch trail, the torch being sort of gone to relays, people bringing it slowly to the venue for the Olympics from Greece, where originally where the Olympics really originally happened, centuries ago. Martin, what are your thoughts about this one? Because it turns out, according to this Guardian article, and also in last weekend's Daily Mail, it was saying that actually this is a whole tradition of having the torch trail from Greece to wherever the Olympics are taking place. It was actually started in the 1930s for the Berlin Olympics by Nazis.
Well, I mean, I didn't know that. And, every day is a school day and we learn something new every day. Whether it was started by the Nazis or not, this is now the tradition. And, it's interesting that it did begin in 1936 and not the beginning of the Olympic movement, if that is true. But I didn't know that.
But it's something that's been taken up, basically. It was started by someone called Carl Diem back in the 30s, who was the committee secretary general for the 1936 Berlin Olympics. To what extent are these games tied up with politics? Are they at all, or is it something completely separate? Because it's certainly something to focus attention on, the sort of grandness of the country that's holding them, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, politics is, of course it's politics. Everything's politics. The Olympics certainly is politics. I mean, certain Olympics have been boycotted. For example, the West boycotted the 1980 Olympics because of the invasion of Afghanistan by the Russians. There's talk of, for example, of the 2012 Euro 2012 football tournament being boycotted because of political problems in the Ukraine. The Olympic ideal is that it brings people together despite the politics. But sometimes, of course, the politics is too sharp and the Olympic ideal doesn't work. And, of course, there's an awful lot of arm twisting and politics inside the Olympic movement in any case.
The Guardian rounds up by saying, "We ourselves might do well to remember the somewhat sordid past of the torch relay when the flame reaches British shores today, Friday. Just as with 1936, the torch can be seen more as a political symbol than a sporting one, just as we witnessed 4 years ago when it made its controversial way around the globe for the Games in Beijing. Then the flame was surrounded by a mob of police heavies, which perfectly represented the controlling nature of the Chinese regime.
Well, what happened there, of course, is that the torch was being carried towards Beijing, but it was Tibetan protesters were protesting about it and so on. I mean, basically, if things like royal meetings and Olympics go ahead, and people are entitled to protest against these things, to use them as a means of getting their as long as they're peaceful, of using their these events as a means of getting their message over. That's all part of the fun, isn't it?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, the Queen of Disco, Donna Summer. Now, you didn't think there was a political angle to this one, but there is. She was absolutely convinced that she had become ill after inhaling particles from 9/11, actually the September the 11th attacks in 2001. A 63-year-old singer who had hits including Hot Stuff, Love to Love You Baby and I Feel Love, she died in Florida on Thursday morning. She'd largely kept her battle with lung cancer out of the public eye. But the website TMZ, which is very closely associated with Donna, reported the singer had told her friends she believed her illness was the result of inhaling all the toxic dust from the collapsed Twin Towers.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who have inhaled toxic dust as a result of the Twin Tower collapsing, and there were three towers collapsing, of course, WCC7 as well, later in the afternoon. And there's a film made about it called Elephant in the Room by Dean Puckett, which was sold a few years ago, and our friend William Rodriguez, who was a janitor in the World Trade Center, was very involved in campaigning for those who basically had their health ruined as a result of the toxic dust that was generated by the controlled demolitions of the towers, because they didn't come down as a result of fires. They were the dust was full of lead, cadmium, and all the other things. You imagine what happens if you reduce a building to dust.
Well, apparently a lot of asbestos too.
Asbestos as well, of course, yes.
But the real controversy is that the authorities in New York all said that the air was safe to breathe.
They did indeed, because they wanted Wall Street back up and running. It was quite obvious that it wasn't safe. But they wanted Wall Street back up and running as quickly as possible. That's, of course, why the buildings collapsed into their own footprints as well. Because, of course, if they'd collapsed, as they should have done through a fire, or if buildings had collapsed through fire, they'd have collapsed sideways and that would have been disruptive. So they all collapsed into their own footprints. It was all done with the massive toxic dust. The asbestos was got rid of. Lots of computers which had fraudulent transactions on were vaporised and so on.
And in this article in yesterday's Daily Telegraph, it says at least 55 rescuers have died as a result of cancer since 9/11, although many were diagnosed with the disease prior to the tragedy. Although at least 75 have been diagnosed with cancer since the attacks, more than 18,000 people claim to have fallen ill due to inhaling dust particles from the collapse of the towers.
They can't get any medical attention because they won't accept, because the government won't accept.
And this number
that
is...
that this was caused by the
it's a bit like Gulf War syndrome or something, isn't it? And the number apparently is constantly increasing. The majority of those affected are rescue workers who spent extended periods near Ground Zero. Several people who died of illness following 9/11, including 8 police officers, have had their names on the World Trade Center Memorial. Many families have sued the city for illnesses brought on by the tragedy, with cases still making their way through the courts. According to air pollution experts, the dust contained asbestos as well as traces of lead, mercury and dioxin. More than 2,500 contaminants were found in the dust, including many known carcinogens. Well, it does make you wonder, doesn't it?
How did thermite, of course.
How did all that dust get into the air? I mean, is it just through a collapsed building?
No. The existence of the dust is very indicative, because the buildings were brought down through controlled demolition, as Richard Gage pointed out in Colston Hall last year, 21st of June last year in Bristol. Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, he heads that up. Basically, all three buildings were destroyed through controlled demolition. And if you think about it, where's the energy in a kerosene fire from an aeroplane to reduce three huge buildings, not to rubble, but to dust? To dust. Now, that implies a huge amount of energy. The kilojoules involved is enormous. And that alone should make people think, hang on a minute, that must have been an explosion that caused that. Nothing else could cause that kind of dust. But of course, if they were to accept that the dust had caused these people's illness, then they'd have to start saying, well, where did the dust come from? Oh, it came from explosions. Ah, well, the buildings were blown up. And that's why they can't accept it. And why many people in the US who are suffering from these effects are not getting any kind of medical attention, because there's no National Health Service over there. You've got to have insurance, otherwise you're dead.
Drive Time on BCFM. 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, sex, spies and seven suspicious deaths. The murky waters of the intelligence world is either a coincidence or a conspiracy. An excellent article a couple of weeks ago by Andrew Malone in the Mail on Sunday, or the Saturday Mail, I'm not quite sure which one. And this is really all about the fallout from the death of Gareth Williams, the so-called spy in a bag. One of the things that occurs to me about this peculiar death in London of this GCHQ cryptographer was simply the fact that it seemed pretty obvious to me that someone was planning to move his body and was possibly disturbed. That's why his body was in a bag. But it's sort of almost obvious things like that that don't really seem to get talked about very much. But what this article by Andrew Malone is looking at, Martin, is that this is just the latest in accusations of bizarre sexual activities for many different spies over the years. Seven, in fact, who've all been accused of these various sort of peculiar sexual activities. For example, Stephen Milligan, the Conservative MP for Eastleigh and former BBC presenter, was found dead in his flat at Chiswick, West London in 1994. Even though it had never been proven, there are strong suspicions that he had links with intelligence community. His body was discovered by Vera Taggart, his loyal secretary, who found the 45-year-old dressed only in suspenders and women's stockings and tied to a chair in his flat in Black Lion Lane near the Thames. The article finishes up really by saying that actually this is apparently a normal technique in the intelligence world in order to make people feel that there's something that they don't really want to think too much about because something very, very strange is going on. But anyway, what about this, particularly this death of Gareth Williams? What are your thoughts
about
him?
It's obviously very difficult to say what's been going on here because we just don't have enough information.
Because MI6 is secret. I think the police are just
frustrated as you are. We've got Britain's top policeman told MI6 last night that no one is above the law as he demanded unprecedented access in a bid to solve the murder of spy Gareth Williams. Commissioner Bernard Hogan Howe said there was nothing in law to stop police making secret agents give statements and forensic samples. So I think there is an issue here about the rule of law, and I think it is very interesting that when these spies die, they're all supposedly died as a result of bondage games. Now, this is actually a kind of... It's almost like a kind of in-joke by MI6, isn't it? That everybody's involved in kinky sex and that's why they all end up dead. You'd have thought they'd have come up with different cover stories for people who've been murdered, different for each one.
Well, Nicholas Anderson...
You know, habit is habit, isn't it?